Please. What could I tell him? This nice man with his nice open face, to explain away what seemed to be my stubborn refusal to help my child. That if Robert talked to the school psychologist about what was bothering him, the jig was up. That bottling up was part of the plan. I knew that for Robert's sake it would be a good idea for him to take a stroll twice a week through the maze of his memories, to try to reconcile the beloved father who'd done terrible things, the trusted mother who'd lied about them, the happy home that had been rotten at the root, like one of those trees in full leaf that blows over in a storm to reveal the hollow trunk. To talk about what it felt like to be suddenly plucked, still half asleep, from one existence, and set down a day later in another strange new one. But he would have to do it on his own. It was too dangerous for anyone else to know our secret. It was too dangerous for Robert to talk about what had really happened, who he really was. If he told a psychologist, he might tell a teacher. If he told a teacher, he might tell Benny. And pretty soon everyone would know, everyone, and Bobby. That was how Bobby would find us, through one missing brick in the wall between that life and this. He'll be okay, Mike Reardon said. I think so, too, I said. One of our goalies was snoring behind us, a bandana covering his shaved head. Shane's starting a new fashion, I said. Head lice, Mike Reardon whispered. We managed to keep it pretty much contained to the fourth grade. Nearly there, folks, the driver said. Crickets were sawing away out in the muggy Florida night. It was already almost Thanksgiving. Do you know Chelsea Rohrabacher? I said, to change the subject. I could see Mike Reardon's teeth in the dim gray light as he smiled. I sure do, he said, speaking of Dr. Stern. I don't know how Cindy does it. It would drive me crazy to have a kid of mine that frightened of that many things. You know what? Mike said. Most kids are that frightened of that many things. They're just too scared to admit it. And so are most adults. I think the amazing thing about Chelsea is that she puts it all out on the table. Mr. Reardon, somebody yelled. Zachary spilled a juice box all over my pants, in the crotch. Go for it, I said. He held up his lottery ticket and kissed it. Please God, he said. I don't know exactly when I started to call him Mike, but I know that was the moment I began to think of him that way. Mr. Reardon, one of the boys moaned. Do you think we'll win next time? Absolutely, he said. For my birthday, Cindy took me to the mall south of Lakota and bought me a decent haircut at a place called the Clip Joint. My birthday was November 10, or at least Beth Crenshaw's birthday was. Franny Flynn's birthday was October 30th, a hateful time to have a birthday, mischief night, the nasty stepbrother to Halloween, a day of soaped windows, egged windshields, staying inside, safe at home. I'd never had a birthday party, unless you counted the cake with buttercream icing and pink roses my mother brought home in a white cardboard box from the bakery on the bottom floor of the office building in Manhattan where she worked. For my sweet 16, I brought the cake home myself from the bakery where I worked. Now I knew the buttercream was made out of shortening and sugar. It's chocolate, my mother had said when I cut into it, and Gracie had said, Fran doesn't really like vanilla cake. You should have known that. She grew up fast, Grace. She always said what she thought. In bed that night, she'd whispered, What if I threw you a big birthday party at the Waldorf Astoria? But I pretended to be asleep. Birthdays. That's how they get you. You wouldn't imagine that, would you? But Patty Bancroft said the biggest mistake people made was changing their name but keeping the same initials and claiming the same date of birth. Patty Bancroft's people had shaved 2 years off my age as well, so that Beth Crenshaw wearing a rubber cape in the beautician's chair that squeaked when you moved in it was 36 years old. "Manicure, pedicure, styling, color," Cindy said in the car. "On me. And Craig'll take the kids out water skiing on Lake Lakota, then maybe Chuck E. Cheese for lunch. Mine are happier than pigs and shit, excuse my language. Chad thinks Robert and Benny are grown-ups, only more fun, and Chelsea thinks they're cute boys, which they are. When's Robert's birthday, anyway?" Someone who thought they knew children but didn't had assigned Robert a date of birth to replace April 30th. 4th of July, I said. "That's a tough one," Cindy said. "No school, so no school party, and everybody doing their own barbecues, beach trips, family deal. On the other hand, you'd always have fireworks. I guess I could work with that." "You want your nails wrapped?" I laughed. "What is having your nails wrapped?" I said. "Oh, it's great. You'll see. They put these little pieces of linen on your nails, spray them until they get hard as a rock, file them, shape them."
"I can't have them too long."
"Don't be so negative."
"No one's messing around with my feet."
"You'll see. This'll be great."
She was right. Cindy was always right about things like that. My hair fell in soft layers around my face, a more buttery, warmer color than my own home dye job. My nails were painted with white tips, and my feet massaged by a Korean woman in a pink smock who smiled all the time. It was pretty clear she didn't understand a word either of us said. It was early on a Saturday morning, and we were the only people in the place except for two handsome, hard-looking, dark-haired women, the elder a shadow of the younger, who came in just as we were finishing. Between them they carried a long white box, and setting it down carefully on the receptionist's formica desk, they lifted out a crown of pearls and beads with a long tail of tulle the color of light coffee.
"Oh, that's gorgeous," Cindy said, watching everything in the salon's wall of mirrors, the ends of her hair falling like dandelion fluff on the shoulders of her rubber cape.
$180 for a veil, just for the veil," said the older woman.
"Don't start," said her daughter, as one of the beauticians began to set her hair in rollers. "It would look beautiful with her hair up. Look at this." She held the veil out to us all, me, Cindy, the woman who was cutting Cindy's hair, the Korean woman who was shaving dead skin from my heels and smiling and nodding. "A chignon inside the band of beading, so that you could really appreciate, you see what I mean? Which would also mean a better view of the back of the dress when she's at the altar. See, they all look at the front of the dress, these girls, but most of what you see during a wedding is the back. You don't want the whole back of the dress hidden by all this hair."
"So you want your hair up?" said the beautician to the bride. The embroidery on her smock said her name was Jenna, and her small pinched features had settled during the mother's monologue into the carefully neutral look I'd learned long ago to adopt with difficult patience.
"I told you what I want when I came in for the consult. I want ringlets. She wants my hair up, but she's not the one getting married."
"You look 100% better with your hair up," her mother said.
"Ma, you want your hair up, you get your hair up. I'm not getting my hair up. It'll ruin the pictures. Chris doesn't like my hair up. I don't like my hair up. I'm not wearing my fucking hair up." "You kiss your mother with that mouth?"
"You're done," said the woman who was blowing Cindy's hair dry. The Korean manicurist handed us our purses so we wouldn't smear our polish.
"Look at how nice her nails look," said the mother, pointing to my hands. "I told you, you should have gotten a French manicure." "Ma, don't start," the daughter said.
Cindy and I waited until we were at the escalator before we began laughing.
"What do you bet she winds up with her hair up?" Cindy said.
"You think?"
"Oh, honey, I know." My head smelled of flowers, and my hands looked elegant, smooth, like they belonged to someone with drawers full of sachets and closets with padded hangers. "They were so Brooklyn," I said.
"So what?"
"Never mind, it's just an old expression. You were right about the pedicure."
"I know I was. Happy birthday, honey."
Those were the times I felt bad about what I was doing. The times when I spoke aimlessly of a life in Wilmington that seemed an empty invention to my own ears. The times when Cindy was telling me another story of another friend getting screwed in divorce court. Cindy thought I was having a wonderful birthday, when my real birthday had been a week before and I'd cried most of the evening, thinking about Gracie somewhere crying too. Gracie always helped me blow out the candles on my cake, even when I was a grown-up. I hated lying to Cindy, hated that I did it more or less every day just by letting her call me Beth. It was all I could do sometimes not to tell her everything. "I bet Mr. Reardon like your hair," Cindy said, pulling the minivan onto the highway. "I bet you have been waiting half an hour to say that ever since I got out of the chair."
"Tell the truth, I wanted to say something in the shop, but that Jenna lives in Lake Plata, so I decided to protect your privacy."
"Thanks so much."
"So what is the deal here?"
"Cindy, you watch too much TV."
"You may be right, hon, but I can tell you that on TV, the soccer coach and the player's lovely single mother wind up together, after many misadventures. Plus, I don't see too many other stars on your horizon. Except for Jim. He's a real romantic guy. That last time you ran into him, leaving our house, I heard him say to the other guy in the truck, 'Man, would I like a piece of that.' What a sweetheart."
Jim was one of the laborers who worked for Craig's pool service. He was tanned from all those hours in the sun, and he took his shirt off every chance he got to display muscle definition that made him look like a Saturday morning cartoon superhero. The ends of his Fu Manchu mustache were always a little wet, and I had thought about what it would be like to sleep with him the first moment I saw him, balancing a shovel across the tight shelf of his shoulders, looking enough like Bobby Benedetto to be a first cousin. He smelled like sweat and chlorine, and I tried not even to look at him, those few times I'd run into him at the Rohrbachers. But once he'd smiled at me, real slow, and I knew he knew what I was thinking.
"Like I said, you watch too much TV," I said to Cindy. "Mike Reardon is a very nice man, that's all."
"Oh, no. A nice man, that tears it. Remember how in high school your girlfriend would go, 'Oh, him, he's such a nice guy,' and what that always meant was that she was dying to go out with a guy's nasty friend.
Well, thank God high school is over."
"Oh, please. Life is high school, except everybody's either 10 pounds lighter or 50 pounds heavier."
I started to sort everyone I knew into one group or another.
"You're right," I said.
"I am right. And I'm right about Mr. Reardon. And please don't tell me you're holding out for Mr. Wright, because he ain't come and he never comes."
And this from a happily married woman.
"I'm happily married because I'm real realistic. The statute of limitations on finding them irritating as hell is 4, maybe 5 years. It doesn't matter how good-looking they are or how much money they make. That's when you start to notice how they can't ever manage to put on a fresh roll of toilet paper or put dirty clothes in the hamper. You've been married, you know the drill. 'Honey, where's my shirt?' 'In the damn closet, dear, where it always is.' Couple years gritting your teeth, and then you just gotta get on with it. Or not, I guess."
She looked over at me.
"What got me going on that?"
"Mr. Reardon."
"Oh, never mind Mr. Reardon. Let me do your makeup when we get home. I got these new neutrals that'll look great on you."
Usually, I resisted Cindy's sample case, but for once I went along with her. She made bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches for us both, and then went to work on me with pencils and foam pads, powders, and creams.
Except for a mouth that was too big for the rest of my face, I looked good when she was finished.
Not a day over 30, she said.
Instead of 36 or 38, another secret to keep straight my very age.
God, I wish you had a hot date tonight, she said. Can I buy your clothes, too? No offense, hon, but you tend to play down your best feature. Your bod cries out for short white shorts and a crop top.
You're the first person I've heard use the word bod since junior year high school.
Oh, one of those little t-shirt dresses would be nice, too, and they're cheap. Dress Barn has them for $40. That's where I got this.
Cindy was wearing royal blue shorts and a print blouse with a ruffle down the front, white sandals, and a matching white belt.
Can I ask you something without pissing you off? I said.
Shoot. How come you do all this? The makeup, the clothes. Don't you get tired of having to look perfect every day?
And Cindy sat down heavily in the chair across from me, all the makeup piled on the glass table between us. With her face sort of sad and serious, she looked like exactly what she was, a former prom queen who'd grown up, gotten married, and fought the good fight against losing her looks.
God, I'm sorry, I said. I can't believe I said such a shitty thing.
Don't rub your eyes, she said, or that mascara will be all over your face.
It's okay, anyhow.
You're the only friend I've ever had who would ask me a question like that. Plus, I think you're the only one I've ever known who I'd know how to answer. You know, most people I'd just say, well, a girl's got to look her best, doesn't she? Or one of those dumbass things you learn to say.
I'd never heard Cindy swear before.
I think it was the farm, you know it? It was just so dusty all the time, and the dirt came in the windows, so that no matter how often you'd dust, there'd be this little bit of dirt that was always on the sills. And my mother would go out to make her deliveries, and she'd smell so good and look so nice, even though she's a kind of plain woman you'll see when you meet her at Christmas. Then next morning, she'd be up in a pair of men's overalls helping my dad out in the barns, and she'd smell like manure. And after a while, I think I got like Scarlett O'Hara in the movie, you know? As God is my witness, I'm never gonna be dirty again. I fell like a ton of bricks my sophomore year for a boy named Jackson Islington, can you believe it? From some little place past Lakota. He was a senior, light-headed boy, but dark eyes. You know how nice that looks sometimes? And you'll know how crazy I was about him when I tell you I was only 15, and he was already putting his hand up my skirt in the car, and I was letting him. He dropped me off one day, and he was talking to my dad for the longest time, and then my dad came in for dinner. I can still remember we were having macaroni and cheese and stewed tomatoes, and my daddy says to me, "That's a nice young man. You don't meet too many anymore who have their hearts set on farming." Lord, you should have heard that boy when I asked him about it next day coming home from school. Talking about the earth and watching things grow and the air in the early morning, making it sound like planting 10 acres of feed corn was like being a priest or something. And then he started kissing me, and he kissed my neck and then lower, the way he always did. I think that was what got me going in the first place. And then he kissed me on the mouth. Stuck his tongue in the way he had a million times before, except that I could taste the dirt. Just taste it, so that I almost gagged. Even now sometimes I think, Cynthia Lee, what was wrong with you? Because when you're 15, you're supposed to be able to just overlook those kinds of things, get all carried away and loopy in love. But I felt his hands on me, and all I could think of was me all scrawny and dark the way my mother was, and dirt on the dining room tablecloth. And that was that. That was that.
There were tears in her eyes, and Cindy dabbed at them with one carefully bent knuckle. Then she laughed, the sort of shaky, gasping laugh you laugh when you're trying to shake tears away, a laugh I'd laughed myself sometimes talking to Grace about things.
First date with Craig. I say to him, What do you think you'd like to do for a living?
He was 17, must have thought I was crazy. He said, I'm going into business.
The pool business gave me pause with all the digging around, but he put that shower in the basement right by the outside door, and he's clean and smelling of Christian Dior before he ever comes up those stairs.
And with that, she lifted her chin and smiled at me. The kind of brilliant smile one woman gives another that might as well be a punch in the nose, so little is it to be messed with. I looked down, fiddling with the tubes and pots on the table, looking at their labels. Terra copper, autumn leaves, sweet peach, sable. Almost despite myself, I started to talk. I had this nun in 8th grade who wanted me to apply to this really good private school. She kept saying that she thought I had potential. Potential. I got to love the sound of that word. It sounds like somebody shot you out of a cannon. And then I talked to my parents about it, and my mother looked at the brochure I brought home. It was on this great paper, I remember, soft and shiny, and there were beautiful color pictures of the kids in their uniforms, in science labs and reading in this big library. And my mother looked at it, and then she just said, why? That's all. It was like my whole life in one word. And it just stayed like that. When I wanted to go on a trip to Spain with the language club or go to college, the answer was always the same. Why? What's the point? I knew it was because they didn't have any money, with my father on disability and my mother working as a secretary, but it didn't feel like it was about money. It felt defeated. I'd look at this picture of the two of them on their bedroom dresser, thin and nice-looking and all happy and smiling, and it was just like defeat had taken over the whole house, until I didn't see the point either. I went to the local parochial girls' school, and then I went to the local nursing school, and then I got married, and I guess I was just grateful for anything I could get. I didn't even really think about it until my sister got older, because they did the same thing to her, except that she didn't pay any attention to them. What's the point, Grace? Take shorthand and typing, Grace. Dr. Edgar the dentist is looking for a receptionist, Grace. She'd just laugh at them sometimes, when we were in our room, make fun of them even. She got herself a scholarship to private school for high school, and she got jobs and grants to work her way through college, and she rented a U-Haul so she could drive cross-country. My mother asked her why she was going all the way to Chicago for school, and she said, because I want to. Like it was the most natural thing in the world to do what you wanted. Sometimes I'd see her looking at me, and I could tell she felt sorry for me. God, that just about killed me. That little Gracie, whose diapers I'd changed, who I sang to and read to, who would yell, "Where Franny?" running around the house, her diaper all droopy around her fat knees, who I taught all the line dances and how to roll her uniform skirt after school, that she would wind up feeling sorry for me. But you know, I had no one, and Grace had me. That gave her confidence, or at least a lesson in how not to do things. I shrugged. She just made herself a completely different life, just made it up from scratch. Well, that's what you did, Cindy said. What? Here, she said. You made yourself a whole new life here, just like your sister did. It's different. Oh, hon, that's what we all say, she said. Of course it's different. Everything's so out of a clear blue sky that everything's always different. Like if I'd taken French instead of Spanish, I might not have known Craig and my whole life would be different. Or if I'd gone all the way with Jackson before I knew what was what, everything would have been different. Scares me to think about it, it would have been so different. And if you weren't as nutty about Robert as I am about Chelsea, I wouldn't have run into you, and that would make things different. I am not nutty about Robert. He was in a new school. He was...
I know. It was different than with Chelsea. That's fine. Anyhow, now we know everything we need to know about one another. You know how come I wear foundation and powder every day, and I know how come you don't. I thought we were just going to get our nails and hair done, and the next thing you know, we're sitting here ripping our guts out.
It's the birthday. There's something about a birthday that makes you think about your life that way. About how you got to be who you are. About whether you're happy with your life.
I guess this might not be the best birthday to ask if you're happy with your life, Cindy said.
I guess you're right. What about you?
Cindy stared up at the ceiling. It was almost as if I could watch the years roll by behind the scrim of her eyes, her thinking about everything that had been, the man, the kids, herself.
I'm pretty happy with my life, she said finally. But it isn't exactly what I expected.
Amen, I said.
She leaned over, gave me a hug, put all the makeup in a tote bag she was giving away free with every order during the holidays.
Who's Franny? She said.
It was such a shock, but I didn't show a thing in my face. Besides, she wasn't looking at me, was looking down at the tools of her trade.
What?
I said.
You said your little sister called you Franny. That she said, "Where Franny?" all the time.
It's an old nickname, I said, my breathing still ragged from talking and listening and feeling. Cindy held out the tote bag, red with black patent trim. My mother-in-law would have loved it.
Well, Franny, honey, she said.
And just the word, that one word, sounded so good in her mouth.
Here's your new face. Happy birthday again. You're a new woman, swear to God.
What happened to Jackson Islington? I said.
I haven't a clue, said Cindy.
What happened to your eighth grade nun?
She left the convent, got married, and became a social worker.
How about that? Cindy said.
The sweet potatoes in the casserole dish on the kitchen counter looked like a photograph from some recipe in a magazine, if I do say so myself. The secrets in the bourbon, boiled down with butter and brown sugar until the whole mess is as thick as maple syrup. It was one of my mother's recipes. One of my mother's only recipes, unless you count the ones she read off the back of the can of cream of mushroom soup. At my mother-in-law's, where we always had Thanksgiving dinner, the sweet potatoes were tolerated, not welcome. The turkey, too, was more centerpiece than main course, filled with sausage and aniseed, surrounded by platters of lasagna and artichokes stuffed with cheese. At Aunt Benedetto's, I used to eat the sweet potatoes myself, so that my casserole would not sit untouched on the sideboard, even though the food she served was always better. In the battle between turkey and lasagna, turkey doesn't stand a chance. The bourbon. That's what my mother always said. And the pecans. They were expensive, the pecans, almost $3 a bag. The bourbon I bought in one of those tiny bottles they serve on the airlines. I was afraid of having booze in the house. The second week we were in Lake Plata, I bought a bottle of cheap Chardonnay, rough and vinegary on the back of my tongue. Yet somehow it only lasted 2 days. After that, no more. Every bit of the bourbon went into the saucepan.
Sweet potatoes are weird, Robert said, poking them with his finger the night before as they sat steaming on top of the narrow stove. But they smell good.
They were crusty, brown and orange, and still fragrant if you put your face close enough, even stone cold on Thursday morning, as I listened to Cindy on the phone, my heart sinking. Her voice was ragged, the static on the car phone in Craig's van like pebbles rolling around in the receiver. It was Thanksgiving, but instead of putting the turkey in the oven, the Rohrbachers were rolling south, down the spine of the state to the retirement village where Craig's parents lived and where, the night before, his father had had a stroke. And the Thanksgiving plans of the Crenshaw family, such as they were rolling away with them.
"I am so sorry," she kept saying. "I am just so sorry."
"Cindy, stop," I said, poking the potatoes. "Things happen."
"I know," she said. "I know."
"We'll make other plans," I said. "The Castros, maybe."
"Oh, I forgot about the Castros," she said, and her voice sounded a little lighter, the static a little more raucous.
Until somewhere along the highway we lost one another with a rattle, a strange sonic shriek, and a still pool of dead and empty air. But of course I knew that the Castros had gone away, too, to celebrate Thanksgiving with some cousins in Orlando who had been, Robert told me, billionaires, before they found it necessary to come to America and be reincarnated, driving cabs, cleaning motel rooms, another brace of people who'd been somebody else once. That morning, when I had stepped into the quadrangle of the Poinsettia complex just to see the sky, to sniff the air, it had the atmosphere of a place that had been evacuated, as though someone had forgotten to tell us about the coming storm, the floods, the tornadoes. But the only natural disaster was the holiday. Our shabby little horseshoe of low-ceiling duplexes was the sort of place to leave for a family gathering, not a place in which to have one. And we were leaving, too, leaving for the Roarbackers, with Cindy's family and Craig's. Until Cindy and Craig and Chelsea and Chad. It almost makes me smile to give all their names together like that, and I still mocked Cindy from time to time. Had gotten on the road at daybreak to travel to a hospital intensive care unit 250 miles away. "Sweetie, we have a problem," I called upstairs to Robert, trying to keep the sound of bad news out of my voice. There was no answer, and I trudged up, looked in on him on the bed, reading a magazine that Benny had given him, an expert's guide to video games. "Remember the game I told you about that you said was way too expensive?" he said. "If I could get a used one for half price, could I buy it?" "I don't know," I said, sitting on the edge of the bed and dancing my fingers up his leg. That was Cindy on the phone. She and the kids had to go to Mr. Rohrbacher's daddy's house. He had a stroke last night, and they had to go right away to see him. So we can't go to their house today.
"So where are we going to go?"
"I don't know," I said.
"I have to write a composition about Thanksgiving," Robert said.
"You don't have to write it today."
"I know, but what will I say if we don't have Thanksgiving?"
How had I forgotten what it would be like to go to a cheap restaurant on that day of all days? I knew in the way a person with scars can remember the pain of surgery. The first Thanksgiving after I met Bobby, he had invited me to his mother's for Thanksgiving. Grace and my mother and father had gone off to my aunt's house in the Catskills, carrying a cheesecake and a bottle of rosé wine, and I had set my hair, shaved my legs, ironed a dress that didn't need ironing. I didn't know that Bobby hadn't told his mother until that morning, and I suppose he didn't know that she would fall entirely apart at the suggestion that there was a strange girl who expected to sit at her table, that white, phony, French provincial table with the centerpiece of wax grapes in a silver basket, the table where only family sat. He sprung it on her, that's the way Bobby put it, as though I was a small animal with sharp teeth waiting to leap at the crepey white skin around Anne Benedetto's neck. I can imagine now what she must have been like that day. Cold, affronted, then tremulous, a shaking hand to her only child's cheek, begging, not today, not today. And so Bobby had changed my plans. I should have had some vision of the future then, as I listened to him talk on the phone.
"It's no big thing," Bobby said. "I shouldn't have sprung it on her like that. She'll get used to the idea. You know, only child, all that. It's no big thing. She'll meet you at Christmas. I'll see you tomorrow. Don't eat too much turkey.
I could have stayed at home, heated up a can of soup, read a mystery novel. Instead, I'd gone up to the boulevard to a Greek luncheonette and had turkey with all the trimmings at a stool at the counter, two stools down from an old man with emphysema who smoked all through his meal.
How was it? Gracie said when they got home, carrying leftover turkey wrapped in tinfoil.
Nice, I said.
They put out a good spread, those people, my father had said, wheezing, falling into his chair and breathing into his oxygen mask as though it was the fountain of youth.
And still, remembering that, I took Robert to the Chirping Chicken. The two of us trudging along the shoulder of the highway because there were no sidewalks. There was no need for any. Everybody rode in cars except for us.
The linoleum and the fake leather on the booths was the color of the sun, so that you felt blinded when you walked inside.
The gravy was the color of the sun, too, bright yellow with flecks of black pepper swimming on its oily sheen. At least it was not gray. That was what I remembered about the food in the luncheonette in Brooklyn, that the gravy was the color of cardboard, and I cried in the bathroom and blew my nose on a square of gray toilet paper, rubbing off the foundation and the powder I'd put on to go to Bobby's. I told Robert that story at the Chirping Chicken, and somehow I made it sound innocuous, even amusing, like something from one of the sitcoms, something that would have a laugh track. That's how I always tried to make life sound for Robert. I couldn't bear for him to feel pathetic, to see me as pathetic, too.
These are really good mashed potatoes, he said. They don't have one single lump.
Did you not really want to go to the Rohrabachers? I said.
No, it was okay. But it's like Grandmom didn't want you to come when you weren't her family. I think Thanksgiving shouldn't be with someone else's family. I think it should just be with your family.
What about Christmas?
Christmas is different.
I always did Christmas at our house. I cooked standing rib roast and Murphy potatoes and caramelized onions, and Aunt Benedetto went to her brother's house on Long Island. Grace came to our house for Christmas, and Mrs. Pinto, whose children all lived in Florida. That was one of my biggest fears when I was out with Cindy at the mall, the possibility of running into one of Mrs. Pinto's daughters, with their big hair and their sharp eyes, fringed with lacquered lashes like anemones.
Nana told me once Daddy hurt his finger on Thanksgiving, and she carried him to the hospital because the cab didn't come. She said he was yelling and screaming, and she was running down Ocean Avenue with him getting blood on her.
I know that story, I said. He needed 11 stitches in his hand. He fell on a bottle out in the backyard. He still has the scar.
It's a big scar. When I got that cut on my head when I was 5, I got stitches, but you can't even see.
Robert raised his bangs to show his smooth, high, golden-brown forehead. There was the suggestion of a straight line across its center, as though someone had drawn faintly with a ruler.
Jesus, Franny, Bobby had said, cradling the boy in his big arms on the sofa in the living room, running his lips softly over the bandage. You should have called me at work. They could have raised me on the radio.
It was only 5 stitches, and I got the plastic surgeon to do it.
You know what, champ? Bobby had said to Robert. When you're grown up, girls will say, Oh, Robert, how'd you get that scar? And you can make up a story. You can tell them it was a racing car accident, or you were in a sword fight. You don't have to say you were bouncing on the bed and you hit the headboard. Which you're never going to do again as long as you live, so help me God. Keep him off the bed, Francis. Do you hear me? Hear me, buddy?
Robert had nodded, burying his face in his father's chest. Bobby had smiled at me over the brown head, so small, so fragile somehow. I'd felt Robert's head with my fingers for years after infancy, to make sure that the bones had joined over the exposed fontanelle, the soft spot.
Why, at that moment, pushing stuffing around the thick white plate with the side of my fork, did I suddenly remember what Patty Bancroft had said at the hospital? Winnie was discussing a case of children brought in and then scattered to foster homes after their mother had been beaten into a coma in the middle of the night by an old boyfriend. The children were asleep, Winnie had said. And Patty Bancroft had answered, spitting out the words, "The children are never asleep. They only pretend to be."
"Daddy broke his leg when he was in high school in a car," Robert added, eating a roll. It was as though he had permission to talk about Bobby because I had done it first. But maybe only a distant Bobby. The Bobby he'd heard about in stories. Not the man he knew. The man who did things while he was sleeping. Or pretending to be.
"He almost got shot, too, when you were a baby," I said, pushing him into the present. "Some man pulled a gun on him in the park, but his partner got the guy to put it down."
"Daddy said it wasn't even loaded," Robert said. "He told me once."
"But he didn't know that until it was over. They were chasing the guy because he'd grabbed somebody's bag on Fifth Avenue."
"He told me."
"Your daddy is a good cop," I said. I didn't know if even that was true anymore. There was that teenager in the projects who said Bobby banged his face against the back divider in the patrol car. There was the minister who said Bobby had used a racial pejorative to a member of the congregation who'd complained when the cops tried to move along some teenagers from in front of a sub shop. I was like most cop wives. He told me just enough to make it a story, but not so much that it'd make it real, feel what he felt, know what he knew. After a while, I couldn't tell if he was a good cop. But at least he'd never come home with money in his pocket I couldn't explain. Hadn't been like some of his friends who suddenly came into A-frames in the Adirondacks or cheesy cruises to the Caribbean. "He's working a lot of overtime," the wives always said, as though they were just passing the time of day, that breezy way they lied. I looked down at my coffee cup. "I was really proud of your daddy then, Ba. I was proud of him lots of times, and I really loved him."
"But he hit you," Robert said. It was the first time he'd ever acknowledged it. Somehow it was like a benediction.
"Yeah," I said.
"Because you did stuff he didn't like."
I sighed. "Not exactly, not really. You know how you know the things that will make me mad, like not doing your homework or being mean to someone or getting in a fight? The thing about Daddy was it was really hard for me to tell what he didn't like. You couldn't really tell what would make him mad, and that made it hard. And even if you don't like what someone does, you can't hit them. When you're mad at someone, you have to talk to them, not beat them up. Beating them up is wrong. It's always wrong."
"You don't hit me," he said.
"No.
You would never hit me."
"I would never hit you," I said.
"Daddy never hit me either."
"I know, Ba. What happened with Daddy and me, it had nothing to do with you," I said. It's what we're supposed to say, isn't it? Whenever a marriage is ripped apart and the kids come tumbling out, tumbling down. And I don't know why, because it's such a big, bald-faced lie that any kid with half a brain could figure it out. Robert just nodded, played with the surface of his pumpkin pie. "That was kind of a dumb thing to say," I added. "What I meant was that it's possible for me and your daddy to be angry at each other without either of us being angry at you."
"I bet Daddy's mad at me."
"Why?"
"For going with you."
I leaned forward, took hold of his hand. It just lay there, a small warm thing, half asleep. "Bah. He'd know that you didn't have any choice in that. He'd know that I made you go."
"I bet he's mad at you."
"I'll bet he is, too," I said.
We walked home then, along the highway, and somehow it was better. Somehow it was good. The wind blew trash across our path, bits of wrappers, foil, and plastic, and we must have looked a sight to anyone passing by. But it felt somehow festive, our isolation, as though we were having an adventure.
I'm full, Robert said, patting his belly, smiling up at me, kicking at a soda can along the gravel verge. I felt the ghost of Bobby at my shoulder, but it was the good Bobby. The Bobby who I'd found sitting quietly in the dark by the side of Robert's bed that night so many years ago when our little boy woke up crying, reliving the fall on the bed, the doctor's hands, the needle with the lidocaine, the operating theater light in his eyes.
I got him, Fran, Bobby had whispered to me, and I'd gone back to bed.
We walked over to the Lakeview with a styrofoam container of food from the Chirping Chicken for Mrs. Levitt. Her hair was every which way when she opened the door, and there was a football game on the television. The living room was dark, but when she saw Robert, she moved around, turning on the lights.
This is a beautiful boy, she said. He should have some soda.
Robert was frightened, I could tell, his eyes ricocheting around the room, lighting on the hospital bed, then bouncing away.
It's all right, Mrs. Levitt said. That's Mr. Levitt. He likes the Green Bay Packers, don't you, Irving?
That's college football, Robert said, looking at the TV.
Ach, said Mrs. Levitt, what do I know? Besides, you don't complain, right, Irving?
Her food was on the kitchen counter, and I put it on a plate and brought it to the card table. The two of us sat on either side of her as she ate, patting her mouth with a paper napkin. She held forkfuls out to Robert, but he shook his head.
You make house calls on holidays, Mrs. Nurse? She said, and I smiled.
We didn't stay long, just long enough for her to feel as if she'd had company on the holiday. As we left, she handed Robert an old, old copy of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, with a dark green cover and a gilt fleur-de-lis on its spine. Inside, in faded ink, was a big, round, florid signature, Irving S. Levitt. Robert clutched the book as we walked home. There were almost no cars on the highway, and the breeze was a little cold, as though even the tropics had to pay homage to the pilgrim's chilly feast. It's as if life stops in America on holidays. Or maybe it's that way everywhere, all over the world, all the places I've never gone, countries I've never seen. It used to be that way on Sundays, when Gracie and I were young. The newsstands and the variety stores were quiet and dark. The open signs in the windows flipped over to closed. The little knots of people at the corners where the buses stopped on weekdays, workdays, were gone. And the streets had a sleepiness like the sleepiness indoors, where working people dozed in their chairs and children chafed at the torpor, bored with checkers and old maid and the bickering of their elders. Now only the holidays, the real holidays, not President's Day or Labor Day, have that bittersweet air of stop time I remember from Sunday, the Sabbath. It was the way life had seemed to me when we'd first arrived in Lake Plata, like falling through nothing. It didn't seem that way as we walked home, the turkey I'd asked the waitress to give us for sandwiches in a plastic shopping bag in my hand. It seemed as though we were taking it easy, having a real holiday, nothing to do, no stories to tell, or to make up as we went along. I love you, sweetie, I said.
I love you, too. If I can get that video game for, like, half price, can we buy it?
Don't push your luck.
Please?
We had a good time the rest of that day. I know because I read about it later in Robert's composition, which made it seem real to me. So real that I put the composition in my bedside drawer after it came home from school. We took out the pot of wallpaper paste I'd bought to paper the bathroom and used it instead to paste pictures from Sports Illustrated to Robert's closet door. Mattingly, Dr. J., Boomer Esiason, even the women from the Olympic basketball team. We sat cross-legged on the floor of his room, which was dingy and had a line of dirty rubber sole marks around the wall a foot above the molding, as though some kid had kicked and kicked and kicked and kicked. We made a mess, Robert and I. We'd never made much of a mess before. The closet door was covered with biceps, long legs, faces. It was almost like company.
We crammed the leavings from the magazine into a garbage bag, and Robert stood back, his fists on his hips, and narrowed his eyes. "This is the coolest thing we've ever done," he said. "Benny's not going to believe this."
"It looks really good," I said.
"How will we get it off?"
"Don't worry about that now," I said.
Then we watched an old movie on television, wound around one another on the scratchy old couch, and ate turkey sandwiches and toasted each other with ginger ale. There was an old jar of maraschino cherries in the refrigerator door, just like in an ordinary house, like my real house on the bay in Brooklyn. The jar of cherries you bought for one guest who drank Manhattans, Bobby's Aunt May, his Uncle Thomas's wife, and that ever after sat and sat on that shelf inside the door. I put a cherry in each of our sodas. "I used to do that for Aunt Grace when we were little girls," I said. "I'd put the cherry juice in, too, and make it a Shirley Temple for her." Maybe that was what did it. Or maybe it was just curling up on the couch with Robert, feeling him warm and pliant beside me, smelling his hair the way I used to smell Gracie's as I pulled it into an unruly ponytail. Or maybe it was just that it was, after all, Thanksgiving. My sister's Thanksgivings were like those horrible short stories in The New Yorker that seemed to have no beginning, no ending, no point. A visiting professor from Oxford who wanted to know all about the Pilgrims. A research assistant whose husband had just left her for another man and who wept in the kitchen and drank too much wine. The couple who lived down the hall from Grace, artists who bought couscous with cranberries in it. Oh, it was funny to hear all about it afterward, and I always did, because the last thing Grace did on Thanksgiving night was to call and tell me all about it. And naturally, she's sitting at one end of the table telling me how satisfying it is to work with her husband, how close it's made them, and he's sitting at my end with his hand on my thigh, she'd say. And, "Have you ever made stuffing with chestnuts? If not, don't, because it sucks." And, "Tell Robert this Brit bought me little plastic pilgrims and I'm foisting them on him when he comes to see me next week." She always called me, just shy of 11 o'clock, Grace did. And so, after Robert stumbled from the couch to his room, his breath smelling of mayonnaise as I kissed him goodnight, I picked up the old rotary phone on the wall in the kitchen, poured myself more ginger ale, and sat on the linoleum cross-legged, my heart going like a mouse in a cage. She knew when she picked up. I could tell she knew by the way her voice was, soft and whispery, not like Grace's insistent alto at all. She had to say it twice. "Hello? Hello?" Because the shock of hearing her overcame me suddenly, knocked the wind out of me. "Happy Thanksgiving, baby girl," I finally said. And my voice wasn't my own either. "Oh, my God," she said, and she started to cry. "Oh, my God. Oh, Franny. Oh, Franny." For a minute or two, all we did was cry. "Where are you?" she finally wailed, and then immediately, in a more ordinary adult Grace voice, "Don't tell me. Don't tell me anything that matters. Don't tell me anything that I can give away."
"To Bobby."
"To Bobby, that son of a bitch."
Her voice thickened again.
"He sat in my living room and he cried. He cried. I almost felt sorry for him. I would have if I hadn't seen your face. Even then, he got to me. I wound up telling him that if I heard from you, I'd make you call him."
Her words caught in her throat, part grief, part fury.
"A week later, he comes back and wants to know, 'Have you called? Where are you? What's your address?' And I said I had no idea, I hadn't heard anything from you. And he accused me of being an accessory to a kidnapping. I couldn't figure out what he was talking about at first. I said, 'Bob, don't forget that I saw her face.' And he says to me, 'That's exactly why you don't want to fuck with me, Grace.'" Did he hurt you? You could hear the hum of the telephone static in the silence. In the moment when Grace tried to decide which would be better for me, the truth or a lie. She went for the lie. Don't we all? No, she said. Don't let him in again, Gracie. You can't take the chance. He just goes out of control. I know. My God, Fran, what you've been living with all this time. We're fine, I said. Robert's fine. He's getting settled. I'm working. I've got a place and a little money. Let me send you more. I can't. I can't give you the address or the phone number. It's not that I don't trust you. It's just safer. The bastard could break my leg and I wouldn't tell him anything. That son of a bitch. My God, Franny, I feel like such a fool. All those years you were taking care of me, such good care, and you were in so much trouble, and I didn't even figure it out or do anything. Nothing. I did nothing. She started to cry again, my little sister, the way she had when she was a child, when I'd hold her head to my chest, hold it still to stop the sobs. I didn't do anything to help you. You didn't know. How could none of us have known? I called Winnie at the hospital. She said the same thing. She suspected, but she said they all told themselves that you wouldn't put up with it. It's amazing how much you'll put up with, I said. I lie in bed at night and think about having him killed and dumped someplace where no one will find him. Sometimes I can't believe it's me. I want him dead. If he were dead, then everything would be fine. You'd come back, you'd be safe. I pray that a car will run him down or that some scumbag on the streets will shoot him. I'm safe now, sweetie, I said, matching Grace lie for lie. Don't talk about killing anybody. Twice, my mailbox has been broken into, and the super thinks it's druggies, but I think it's him. I had my phone checked for bugs. Jesus, Grace, he wouldn't bug your phone. Oh, yeah? You sit there and tell me you're sure he wouldn't do that? He might, I finally said. We were both silent again, the silence of two people who have long lived with and loved the sound of each other's breathing. That's what I wanted Robert to do when he was grown up, living a life away from me. I could hardly stand to think of it, but when I did, I thought of telephone calls when I would just listen to him breathe over the line. How's Mom? I finally said. The same. She told Aunt Faye you had decided you needed a change of scene. She told me that Bobby was rude to her when he came to her house. Rude. Jesus God, what an understatement. He was really rude to me, Grace Ann, she says. Oh, I bet he was, I said. Never mind. Tell me the dinner story. What? You know. She thought I was crazy, wanting the old familiar story of her Thanksgiving dinner, the story of the strange food, the urban strays. But she did it. There'd been a defrocked priest who'd been prominent in the anti-war movement a quarter century before, who brought a bottle of good wine and then drank the whole thing himself. It's the first time I've ever heard anyone actually use the word imperialist in conversation, Grace said. There was Grace's lesbian friend, Trudy, who taught Virginia Woolf and Gertrude Stein, and got into an argument with everyone else at the table about whether the virgin birth meant Mary was gay. There were two old women from the building who sounded like second cousins to Mrs. Levitt, who brought rutabagas that had turned out to be surprisingly good. And a graduate student from American Samoa who felt compelled to tell Grace in the kitchen just as she was whipping the cream for the pie that he loved her. Oh, for God's sake, Ramon, cut that pie and put it on plates, I told him. And that was the end of that, Grace said in her old, wry, dismissive, strong Grace voice. We went out to dinner at a pretty bad restaurant, I said softly. It was nice. We went to see one of my patients. We watched Miracle on 34th Street after. I think that's why I called.
We watched it, too, Grace said. Trudy cried and said she'd always been in love with Natalie Wood.
We were watching the same movie at the same time. That's pretty good.
I miss you so much, Grace said.
I know.
Give Robert a hug and tell him I miss him, too.
I can't, Grace. I can't tell him I talked to you. I can't confuse him too much about now and then, here and there. I can't stay on too much longer, either. I'm afraid. I'm afraid for you, mostly. There was silence again.
Breakfast at Tiffany's is on the movie channel at midnight, Grace said. You want to watch it together?
We don't get cable here.
Will you call again?
Grace said. If it's safe, I said. I'm with you every day in my mind. I'm running.
I'm running with you in my mind, Grace said.
I put down the phone in Florida, and she hung up in New York.
I bought Robert the game he wanted for Christmas and hid it in the crawl space above the second floor. I bought Cindy a small, sweet landscape I saw in a poster shop at the mall, and Mike Reardon a nylon jacket for running on rainy days. I bought presents for all my patients, although we weren't supposed to. A computer game for Jennifer, full of dragons and demons and a female superhero in a breastplate. A book for Melvin on smart investing and a romance novel for his wife. And for Mrs. Levitt, a 3-year subscription to People magazine. Christmas was coming, and I had enough money to buy presents.
No one asked for the rent. I didn't get a phone bill.
There were calluses on my heels from my running shoes. When the phone rang now, I just answered it. Listened to the home care agency ask about taking on a short-term assignment. Cindy asked whether I wanted her to drive me to school for soccer practice. The school to ask if Robert could take Tylenol for a headache. Twice it rang and no one was there.
That happens to everyone, I told myself. To everyone.
You all right?
Cindy said one morning in the library. I'm not sleeping real well, I said.
Ladies, Mrs. Petrinian said, not too loud, please. You tried taking melatonin?
Cindy said.
One of the moms at Gymboree swears by it, says she can't even manage to stay up for the news now.
When we went back to her house that morning, she made me muffins and searched her medicine cabinet for sleeping pills.
Nothing but under-eye concealer, hun, but to tell the truth, you could use it, she said.
Do I look that bad?
You look tired, sort of frail.
I don't know, some men like that look. Some men like single women in their 20s with no kids.
You just stay away from those men and keep on running round that track.
You got a one-track mind, I said.
Ha ha,
Cindy said.
I told Cindy about Grace and a little about our parents, although I placed them all in Wilmington, Delaware, along with two older brothers and the accountant from whom I was divorced. I changed the subject Gracie taught from American studies to English literature, and I never mentioned Hunter College. I told her that my father had died of cancer, not of the emphysema he'd picked up as a